Here is note some of the questions that I was asked yesterday during and after the talk, and provide some references. As far as the Witten index, the best thing remains his original paper, Constraints on Supersymmetry Breaking. This is the reference. It's a pretty thick paper, but it's definitely worth reading. Somebody asked about the topology in the Witten index, and this second paper contains a lot of that. It's about Morse theory and supersymmetry. I believe it's partially what you got the field medal for. Anyway, it's also a very thick paper, and people who are mathematically inclined will get a lot of pleasure out of reading it, I'm sure. On the same topic, there are chapters in this book. This is a big book, contains all kinds of subjects, all kinds of things in it, but the chapter is devoted to supersymmetry in dimensions 0, 1, and 2. It discusses supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and it discusses also these issues discussed here, probably in a shorter fashion. The first author is Corey, my colleague from Toronto, and there's 8 authors, so I'm bound to forget somebody. This is why I'm even not trying to mention them. And it's an American Mathematical Society publication by the Clay Institute or something like that. It's a very thick book, costs a lot of money, but you can find it in the library probably. And as far as dynamical supersymmetry breaking in 4 dimensions, which you won't have much time to devote to, there is a review that Sandeep Trivedi and I wrote a few years ago, and it contains many references. In particular, the difference between this and this is that in between came cyborg duality and the understanding of the better understanding of strongly coupled supersymmetric theories. So the main things that you will find discussed here that you don't find here are things related to the application of those ideas to supersymmetry breaking in 4 dimensions. And there is plenty of references there. So that's as far as literature goes. Let's remind ourselves of what we did last time. You've had many lectures on many different topics. We studied a supersymmetric system, the simplest supersymmetric system with an algebra that we wrote in many different ways, but one of the ways was this. And Q and H commute, which actually sort of follows from the first, but I can as well write it. Bar and dagger is the same. Let's use dagger. So we studied various general properties of the spectrum of this system. We showed that all energy levels are positive, non-negative definite, that the energy is zero if and only if the corresponding state is annihilated with the, by the vacuum. We showed that all non-zero energy levels are doubly degenerate. And we introduced the concept of a Witten index, which tells us whether the theory can break supersymmetry or not, but it doesn't tell us whether supersymmetry actually breaks or not in a given theory. So that was that, and the Hamiltonian that we studied was, we gave an example of a theory that obeys this algebra. The Hamiltonian that we studied was that of a particle moving on a line in a potential which had the peculiar form that it was the square of a derivative of a function, and then there was a spin-orbit interaction of this form. And this thing acted on wave functions of the form like this, basically a Pauli spinner. And the system that we started the class with was the system where W of x was a quadratic function, in which case this reduces to the supersymmetric oscillator that we started with. And the Hamiltonian is that of an electron moving in a magnetic field, describing the motion in the direction perpendicular to the magnetic field. And so we concluded that the Landau levels, which are the energy levels of this electron, are the simplest system that exhibits this algebra for g equals 2. So what we're going to do today is to depart from this topic, because we want to go to higher dimensions. And the first topic that we want to study is how to write the most general actions or Hamiltonians of theories which are supersymmetric. And to this end, we need to develop some technology which is called superfields, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to develop it for this algebra, but it is very straightforward to generalize for the four-dimensional case, which hopefully we will also do today, at least for some fields. And using this knowledge will enable us to write the most general Lagrangians or Hamiltonians of supersymmetric theories in dimensions, 1, 2, 3, and 4, where in 4, by most general, we will mean most general theory with an n equal 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So that's the goal. Now, everything we did so far was done in the Hamiltonian formalism. Usually we do field theory in the Lagrangian formalism. So the first thing you want to do is take this Hamiltonian and write it down into a Lagrangian. And when we do that, we will see that what we end up looks very much like what could be called a one-dimensional quantum field theory. And we will learn how to write the most general supersymmetric Lagrangian in one-dimensional quantum field theory. We'll develop our technology, and then we'll quickly generalize it to 4 dimensions. I could have started from 4 dimensions, but as I said, I'm lazy and there is a large number of indices involved, and it will be very nice to go by analogy and leave all the indices to you in the end of the day. So that's the strategy. So let's take this Hamiltonian and note that sigma 3 can be written, first of all, this is its definition, and it can be written like this. Where this is just a tautology, you can check. I will call this object psi bar, and I will call this object psi. So this will be psi and psi bar. The reason I'm calling this object that is that, you can tell that the Grassmann numbers, psi and psi bar, square to zero. And also, they obey a commutation relation, or rather an anti-commutation relation, that psi psi bar is 1. And you can check that with that definition. And so if I write the Hamiltonian in those terms, I will find something that should look familiar. The Hamiltonian is 1 half p squared plus w prime of x squared with a 1 half plus 1 half w double prime of x, psi bar psi minus psi psi bar. Now this last part is interesting. It looks very much like the mass term of a Dirac Hamiltonian, right? A Dirac Hamiltonian normally would have also a kinetic term, which would be the derivative in the spatial directions, but because we are in quantum mechanics, there is no spatial direction. We're doing D equal 1 field theory. So this looks like the only thing that can possibly be in the Dirac Hamiltonian. And also the fact that psi psi bar is 1 means that I can call psi bar the conjugate momentum of psi. So I psi bar is really pi psi. And so then the fermion term in the interaction can also be written as like this. What I'm doing is I'm trying to write the Lagrangian for this system in a least painful way. So this last term is minus I over 2. W double prime, pi psi psi, minus psi psi psi. Oh, it's hard to pronounce. And now having this Hamiltonian in this form, we can use the, can everybody see that? We can use the Hamiltonian equation of motion to write down the Lagrangian. And I will keep only the fermion part, because for the bosons, everybody knows how to do that. And actually, for the fermions, probably too, but let's just do it. So psi dot is dh d pi psi, which is minus I w double prime of x psi. And then the Lagrangian for psi is I psi bar psi dot minus 1 half w double prime of x So this is just the fermion part of the Lagrangian. And finally, we end up with a Lagrangian, which is our first supersymmetric Lagrangian. We're going to write many of those. I erase this. So here's our Lagrangian. It's 1/2 x dot squared, of course, minus 1/2 w prime of x squared, plus I over 2, and we'll keep that Lagrangian, and 1/2 OK, so this is our Lagrangian. So the field in this Lagrangian are x of t and psi of t. So we have one bosonic and one fermionic field, which are functions of the only one space-time coordinate t. So a bunch of trivial rules about complex conjugation, where we complex conjugate two Grassmann variables. We change the order. That's part of the definition. They anti-commute. The derivative of this product with respect to the first thing is the second thing, while the derivative of this with respect to the second thing is minus the first thing. Minus psi. In the Lagrangian, these things are simply anti-commuting variables. So in the Lagrangian, psi and psi bar commute. So we have a d equals 0 supersymmetric quantum field theory. And to those of you who are familiar with the four-dimensional one, this should look familiar. I wanted to add one more note of caution, or rather remark, not note of caution. Some of you tried to apply our discussions, it was evident from the questions, of supersymmetry breaking in the Witten index. Our discussions were based on this theory with a real superpotential. The superpotential here is a real function of a real variable. Some of them tried to apply it to, or were confused by me to do that, to apply that to what they have heard about the four-dimensional story with the superpotential. So in four dimensions, there is no supersymmetric theory where the superpotential is a real function. This business and this algebra actually can be thought as the dimensional reduction of the supersymmetry algebra with smallest amount of supersymmetry in three dimensions. So this is the reduction of n equal 1 3D algebra. The n equal 1 3D algebra has two supercharges. There is no such algebra in four dimensions. So this theory, when you start with the three-dimensional one, if you reduce one of the dimensions, you get a two-dimensional, what is called 1, 1 theory. And if you reduce one more dimension, you end up with this theory. So if I did dimensional whatever, anti-reduction, I would end up with this. And this, it would stop. In higher dimensions, this algebra doesn't exist. The algebra that you may be familiar with and the Lagrangians that you may be familiar with exist in four dimensions and lower. And those are Lagrangians where the superpotential is a holomorphic function of a complex variable. So we'll get to those Lagrangians later today. But don't try to apply the Witten index that we did for this and the pictures that we drew for this to a theory with a complex superpotential. Okay? So what I'm going to do now is the following. I want to develop some technology which will allow us to write the most general supersymmetric Lagrangian in this theory. This technology will trivially generalize to this case, basically by adding some indices, and with also a little bit less trivially, but also generalize to the four-dimensional n equal 1 case. So this is my first goal today. And the idea is to introduce the concepts of superspace and superfields. Turns out to be very useful for the study of theories with less than 4 supercharges, which are the one of interest to me anyway. So we have this algebra, and recall that the Hamiltonian is the generator of time translations. So instead of h, I could write ddt. So the same algebra, I can also write like this. And the factor of 2 appears there for historical reasons. You know that I can always rescale things. So this is this algebra rescaled somehow. And I use q and q bar instead of q dagger. So, so in some sense, this is telling us that we have taken a square root of the translation in space. Space meaning in this case, time. And the idea of superspace is just like the Hamiltonian is a generator of time translations, to think of the supercharges as translations in some fermionic directions. So a superspace, a point in superspace, is a collection of these things. So in addition to the bosonic coordinate of superspace, we invent a fermionic coordinate, theta, and its complex conjugate, theta bar. So theta bar is nothing but theta dagger. And these extra coordinates are anti-commuting, so they square to 0. And theta bar anti-commute, obviously. And we want to think of the supercharges as translations in this space, superspace. And we know that the Hamiltonian is represented by this differential operator. And the idea is to find differential operators which represent the supercharges and obey this algebra. And I just write the answer, and then we can check. So this is a supersymmetry one supersymmetry generator, and its Hermitian conjugate is this bar, this one. So we can check various properties of these operators. First of all, they are nilpotent, and they are nilpotent. And I leave you to check this. Check. It's actually fairly straightforward because if you square q squared, you just write q and then you write q. When you multiply d d theta with d d theta, you get 0. When you multiply these two things, you get 0. And then the cross terms in the two terms cancel because d d theta and theta bar anti-commute. And then you get 0. So that was the quickie answer. And we need to show that they obey the algebra. So let's do one exercise. And this will be the one. So we want to show that qq bar plus q bar q is minus 2i ddt. So to calculate qq bar, we do this. And then we just multiply by the other one. And we just carefully collect these terms. Of course, when you do these things, you imagine that there is something that these things act on the right-hand side. So you're careful. So the first term is dd theta bar. Then there is, when this acts on this, there will be two terms. One term is plus I theta dd theta ddt, and the other term is minus I ddt. So this term arises when this actually acts on this theta. The other term arises when it acts on whatever. It's on the right-hand side, and I just pulled it through the theta. That's why the sign changed. And here I have plus theta bar theta d2 dt squared. So that's one order. Let's do the other order, qq bar. So let's try to see whether we'll make a mistake or not. Here we get minus this times this. On the last side, we get plus theta bar d2 dt squared because the order is opposite. And let's be careful about this one multiplying this term. Sorry, this one multiplying this term. One term is minus I ddt. Not good. Not good. OK, let me look in the notes. You see, that's why we don't do exercises. What did I do wrong? OK, sorry. Oh, the first term, there is a minus sign here, of course. First of all, I missed that. then this one with this one gives me this. Yes? And this one with this one gives me this is correct. OK, good. I think the first one is correct. The second one is this times this is a minus sign. Good. This times this gives me minus I dt. And when I push it through, it gives me plus I theta bar dd theta bar ddt. And I missed something. Yes, I missed something on both lines. I missed this guy multiplying this guy, and I missed, okay, in the first line. Are you with me? So there is a term missing on the first line. Because when I multiply this by this, I miss that, which is plus I theta bar dd theta bar minus ddt. OK. So it's this times this, right? That was missing from the game. And similarly here, I have to include this times this, which is this times this, which is minus I theta dd theta ddt. And we'll find a mistake if they don't cancel now, OK? So what's happening when I add them up? This one cancels this one because the order is opposite. And they anti-commute, OK? This one should go away. And it goes away with this one. This one should go away. It goes away with this one because you have to switch those two. They anti-commute. And this one should go away with this one, and it does, OK? And so we're left with minus 2i ddt, which is what we wanted to show. You see why I want to do one dimension. You understand now. Because if we add extra indices to that, we have to worry about that too. In any case, we are done with our exercise. We show that these operators are realize the supersymmetry algebra. By the way, this is the easy part. Given any supersymmetry algebra, you can always invent a superspace and differential operators that realize that algebra. The hard part is to invent the superfields. In this case, it will be very easy. And it turns out that going up to n equal 1 in 4 dimensions, it's very easy. And when you increase the number of supercharges, in 4 dimensions, if you try to do n equal 2 in 4 dimensions in a superfield formalism, you find that there is hardly anything useful. And the reason is it's a very difficult task to find the superfields which transform irreducibly under supersymmetry. Many people have tried, and the best they have come up with is something called harmonic superspace, which you want to stay away from. And if, if any of the authors are your advisors, please do not convey my message, okay? Okay. So, all right, these are differential operators, right? But when you have differential operators, you ask yourself, what do they act on, okay? These are differential operators. Obviously, they involve differentials with respect to time and t and theta and theta bar, which are the superspace coordinates. So they must act on functions on superspace. And what the hell is a function on superspace, okay? Well, there are thick books trying to formalize that. But for me, it's a very simple thing, all right? For me, a function of time, theta, and theta bar is defined in terms of its Fourier expansion with respect to theta and theta bar. Sorry, not Fourier, Taylor expansion with respect to theta and theta bar. So I define that as a function of t plus theta times f1 of t plus theta bar times f2 of t plus theta theta bar times f3 of t. So for me, this is a definition of a function on superspace. Okay? And because I only have that many thetas, I cannot have higher components in the expansions because every higher component in theta would vanish. So a superfield is actually a collection of four fields, four normal fields. So a superfield can obey many different properties. And they're basically classified by the properties of the lowest components. So here I can declare that the lowest component of this superfield is bosonic. So it's a normal bosonic field. Then I will call this a bosonic superfield. If the lowest component is bosonic, then clearly this component will be fermionic, and this component will be fermionic, but this component will be bosonic. If the lowest component is fermionic, vice versa, the whole thing has to be fermionic. Therefore, this and these are fermionic, and these two are bosonic, and this one is fermionic. So there are bosonic superfields as far as fermionic superfields. Okay? But the general superfield in this theory is this. If you have a theory with more thetas and more supercharges, then you will have as many component fields as many different powers of thetas that don't vanish, you can write down. Right? You will see that in four dimensions. So another terminology is that this we call the superfield, and these guys we call the component fields. The lowest part of the superfield, which is obtained when you put theta and theta bar to zero, is called the lowest component of the superfield, whereas the highest component, the one that contains the highest possible number of thetas, is called the highest component of the superfield. So we'll use this terminology. So this is lowest component, and this is highest component, and that's true for any superfield. And this is superfield. So these differential operators act on these superfields. Superfield can be real and or complex, depending on whether this is a real function or complex function. And the superfields that we will study in this theory, turns out that this Lagrangian, you can write down in terms of a single real superfield in this theory. So we will consider a real bosonic superfield. SF stands for superfield. Okay? Real means it's real, and bosonic is bosonic. So we'll call it phi of t theta and theta bar, and it will have four components, which we'll suggestively name. There's some interference going on here. So X and F are real bosonic functions, right? We will see that the X, the psi bar, and the psi will actually map to those. Psi and psi bar are complex conjugate, and the field is real, and this minus sign here takes care of that. So the field obeys phi dagger equals phi. So this is real. And you please check that. This is real. And these two are complex conjugates, just like over there. And so now we have a field, and we want to invent an action of the supersymmetry transformations on the field. The supersymmetry transformation on the fields act by basically as these differential operators. So this is a superfield. The Suzy transform delta phi of t theta and theta bar is basically given by the action of this operator, this differential operator on the field. So out of the So epsilon and epsilon bar are parameters of the supersymmetry transformation. These parameters are constant constant Grassmann variables. So these are Grassmann parameters of Suzy. Epsilon bar is epsilon dagger. So there is two real or one complex parameters of the supersymmetry transformation. And by delta hat, I have defined these two differential operators. This one is delta hat epsilon, and this one I have, with the minus sign, I have defined it to be delta epsilon bar. And they are acting on phi, I apologize, yes. So the analogy is basically by time translation. A time translation would act on the field in the same way, except that you would have bosonic parameters times ddt rather than q. And this, so a superfield is basically a function of t theta and theta bar, which under supersymmetry transformation does that. That's the definition. And now we want to find what are the transformations of the component fields. And the way we find that is the following. So we look at the transformation of the superfield, which is epsilon q minus epsilon bar q bar phi. And of course, the result is supposed to be still a superfield. And so this should be delta x of t plus theta delta psi bar of t plus theta bar minus, sorry, delta psi of t plus theta bar theta, no, theta theta bar delta f of t. And so what do? You take these differential operators, you act on the field phi, whose component expansion you know, and then you compare the result to this. And that tells you what the transformations of the various component fields are. And the answer is, can you do it? And if there is any exercise to do, you should do this. Because then you will look at Wessenberger and will say, oh yeah, it's obvious, right? So show that delta epsilon on x, I will just give you half of the supersymmetry transformations, those generated by epsilon. The other ones follow by complex conjugation. So delta epsilon x is epsilon psi bar. And there is a typo in the notes, which I will note. Delta epsilon psi is 0. Delta epsilon psi bar is minus I epsilon x dot minus epsilon f. And delta epsilon f is minus I epsilon psi bar dot. This thing is, this dot here is missing in the notes, but you find it. Plus complex conjugation to get epsilon bar transforms. And you do it yourself. So what are we finding? We're finding that the transformations of supersymmetry acting on the fields of our theory are generated by this anti-commuting parameter epsilon and its complex conjugate. And we find that the lowest component transforms into one of the fermion components. The fermion transforms into the highest component and also the derivative of the lowest component. And the highest component transforms into a total derivative. This last point is very important, because when we start writing Lagrangians, we will see that all supersymmetric Lagrangians are integrals over space-time of highest components of superfields. And the reason that is the reason that they're supersymmetric is that the integral, the highest component under supersymmetry transformations, transforms into a total derivative, and therefore the action with appropriate boundary conditions is invariant under supersymmetry transformations. We will see that more carefully in the next, not slide, but blackboard. So how do we write supersymmetric actions? Well, this argument is suggestive that I just mentioned, that the highest component of the superfield transforms into a total derivative. So if I just integrate f over ddt over dt, I'll get something which is invariant. Another way to see that is to note that if f is a superfield, so is f squared, sorry, phi squared, phi cubed, etc. In fact, any function of phi is a superfield. So if the components of phi have these transformations, then the corresponding components of f of phi have transformations like this too, where you substitute for the component fields of phi for the component fields of f of phi. The way you find the component fields of f of phi is simply expand the function in Fourier components in theta and theta bar. So since supersymmetry transformations are translations in superspace, basically that's what they boil down to when you stare at the algebra, it makes sense that any integral over the entire superspace will be invariant under supersymmetry transformations. So let's consider a theory with more than one field. Let's consider a theory with fields phi I, many fields. So quantum mechanics, not on the line, but on sort of a multidimensional space. And then let's consider the following function now of these fields. I take some function of the phi i's. So this function I'll just call S. All right, so that's a function now of our superfields. And that's a function of the superfields, which of course itself is a superfield. So what I want to find is, and this is an arbitrary function. What I want to find is, what is the variation of this functional under supersymmetry? Well, what do I do? Delta S is integral dt d theta d theta bar f of phi I plus delta phi I minus f of phi I, which I can write as an integral dt d theta bar, and then to leading order in delta, I write that as epsilon q minus epsilon bar q bar, acting on what? Is acting on the derivative phi I. This is sort of df d phi I, which is of course the same as this operator just acting on f. Use chain rule. So this is my transformation under supersymmetry. We'll see that that actually will turn out to be very equivalent to what I just said, but it's probably a good exercise. So let's consider part of this transformation. And let's consider the epsilon q part. The epsilon q part is like epsilon dd theta minus or plus epsilon theta bar ddt. Right, that's what it is. Okay, and that's acting on f. And I just wrote that particular part. So these two terms vanish for different reasons. The first term vanishes because this gets rid of the corresponding theta in what stays on the right. This means that in the integrand over the entire superspace, this theta is now absent. But this means by Bayesian integration rules, the integral is zero. Right? Remember, the rules are that d theta theta is 1, d theta is 0. So this gets rid of that theta, and then this integral vanishes. The second part, you cannot apply this argument, but in the second part, the thing is a total derivative, so it vanishes upon partial integration over dt. Note that this is completely equivalent to this argument, because upon taking integral over the entire superspace of a general superfield, this automatically picks up the highest component of the superfield. Right? The integral over d theta bar, the highest component with this, right, is 1, whereas the integrals of all the lowest components are 0, because you don't have thetas to soak up the Bayesian integration. So it's completely, this is completely equivalent to this argument. So now we know how to write supersymmetric actions. We take our superfields, we write a general function of those superfields, we integrate over the entire superspace, and we get something which is automatically supersymmetric. And so the next task is to find out what it looks in normal person's notation. Why? Because normal persons work with fields. They don't work with superfields. Again, don't tell your advisors. So let's consider how to find the component action that corresponds to, in our theory, to the following superspace action. So consider this. You have to adopt some convention on higher order this, but we won't bother. We will take them to be this order. So let's consider a real function W of the real superfield. So how do we calculate this integral? Well, as I said, you calculate this integral by decomposing W as a Taylor expansion in theta and theta bar, and then evaluate the integrals. So a very useful exercise is to do this. that this function W of the superfield phi can be expressed in the following manner. It's W of X, where X is the lowest component of the superfield, plus theta psi bar minus theta bar psi, W prime of X, plus theta bar, F W prime of X, plus W double prime of X, psi bar psi. So again, what I did is I wrote W as a function of X plus theta psi minus theta bar, or whatever it is, plus theta bar F. And then I just did Taylor expansion, which terminates because the theta series terminates, and that's what you get. And then by doing this integral, the only thing that's left over is this, with a minus sign, because the theta and the theta bar here come in different order. At least this is what I got. So we'll go with that. So SW then is that, and it's integral dt minus F W prime of X minus W double prime of X psi bar psi. So we got an action which is supersymmetric, but it's not quite what we want. And I'm sorry, let me write what we want. Or what we had was this. Well, get rid of the rest. What we had was that. And we only got something that remotely looks like this. In fact, if you combine the last term in the Lagrangian into one term, which you can do because in the Lagrangian these things are simply anti-commuting, you get precisely the last term. But we don't get this, and we don't get this. We don't get the kinetic terms. And we get something that is not quite this. So what are we about to do? Clearly, we have to consider more general functions of the superfield, right, for our superfield actions. And again, so long as we integrate a superfield over the entire superspace, we are guaranteed to get something which is supersymmetric. So it helps, as usual, to do some dimensional analysis. Okay, so let's do dimensional analysis and figure out what we need. Ultimately, we want to get an x dot squared, right? We want to get the kinetic energy for that thing. So what are the dimensions? I need more space. So the dimension of time is minus one, as usual in mass units. The dimension of theta is minus one half. And we'll see that in a moment. That will be true in any dimension, by the way. It's a useful thing to remember. So dimension of time is minus one. We want the action, integral dt, x dot squared, to be dimensionless. And therefore, the dimension of x is minus one half. So our bosonic field in dimension zero has dimension minus one half. And the reason is that there are two time derivatives, so x squared has to have dimension of time. So x has to have dimension of square root of time, so that's it. The dimension of psi is zero by the same arguments that psi dot has to have a integrated over t has to have dimension zero. And therefore, the dimension of theta is minus one half. And of course, the dimension of theta bar is the same because it's just the complex conjugate. For Grassmann variables, the dimension of the derivative and the dimension of the integral are the same. And they are, of course, opposite the dimension of theta. Because integral d theta of theta is 1, the dimension of 1 is 0, so the dimension of d theta has to be the same. And of course, the integral equals the derivative, so it has to have the same dimension. Do we need anything else? Oh, yeah, so our superspace measure, dt, d theta bar, then have what dimension? Is 0. Why is 0? Because dt has the same dimension of t, has dimension minus 1, and there are two guys of dimension plus 1 half, so it has dimension 0. So what is the dimension of our superfield? The dimension of the superfield is the same as the dimension of x, because the lowest component is x of t. So the dimension of the superfield is the dimension of x, and it's minus 1 half. Okay? And we want to get in the action something which our superspace action has to have dimension zero because our measure is dimension zero. So what we are integrating in also has to have dimension zero. So superspace action must have dimension zero. And so we also want to get the x dot squared term. So just by dimensional analysis, the following object seems to have the right dimension. If I take dd theta phi, that's dimension zero. So dd theta phi, dd theta bar of phi, would be something which is real, right? Just do the complex conjugation, and it has the right dimension. So it's real and has the right dimension. To be part of S, to be a kinetic term. The problem is it is not a superfield. And let's see why that is. So if phi is a superfield, its theta derivative is not. Problem, dd theta phi is not a superfield. And what that means is that, of course, it's a function of t theta and theta bar, but it is not a superfield, meaning it doesn't transform under supersymmetry as it should. And the reason for that is that its supersymmetry transformation would be dd theta of delta phi. But remember that delta was epsilon q minus epsilon bar, and dd theta and q don't commute, which is not equal to delta of, or rather, epsilon q minus epsilon bar of dd theta phi, because dd theta and q is non-zero. So this leads us to the following problem. We want to find the generalization of dd theta, which anti-commutes with q. In other words, we want to find the covariant derivative. So instead of dd theta and dd theta bar, we want to use some derivatives which have a dd theta component of them, but have the property that when they act on the superfield, the resulting object is still a superfield, which transforms in the right manner. And that will be another candidate superfield that we can write in our actions. So goal, we want to replace dd theta by d and dd theta bar by d bar such that dq, and they have to anti-commute with both supercharges, plus complex conjugate. So a complex conjugate will be the complex conjugate relations that will involve d bar. Well, that's very easy to fudge the result. In fact, you can simply write the result. So by demanding dd theta plus something q bar is zero, we arrive at d equals dd theta minus I theta bar ddt, and d bar equals minus dd theta bar plus I theta ddt. A lot of operators in this business, but this is just how it is. And these operators obey these relations, and you can very easily check that they commute with q and q bar. So here's a q bar was minus dd theta bar. No normal person can possibly remember that. It's somewhere. Minus I theta ddt. And the other one was this. So you can see that all of this set anti-commutes with this set. And the d and d bar itself themselves don't anti-commute, but they obey an algebra similar to the supersymmetry algebra, however, with a minus sign. and they're they're nilpotent as well. So this is the algebra of the covariant derivatives. These covariant derivatives always play an important role in writing supersymmetric action in any dimension. So it's important that we write them down. So what is this telling us? Because D anti-commutes with Q, then the transformation of a superfield, which you obtain by acting not with d theta but with d on phi, will be just like for any other superfield. And so this will be a superfield. The function of that superfield will be a superfield. And so its highest component will be supersymmetry invariant. So we can write, we have another tool to write supersymmetric actions. So this suggests that this term that has the right dimension to be part of the action and give us a kinetic term can be generalized by replacing the theta and the theta bar with d and d bar. And so the candidate for superspace action that hopefully will give us the kinetic term is an integral over the full superspace of d phi d bar phi. So let's work that out. So S kinetic candidate is some number that we will determine times integral dt d theta bar, d phi, d bar phi. So how do we calculate that? It's the normal sort of mindless procedure. We have to work out the component expansion of d phi and d bar phi, and then take the highest component of the product, and that presumably will be our kinetic term. So one more thing. This is, of course, supersymmetric. It's real, and it involves no dimensionful parameters, which is what we want of the kinetic term. So it's a good candidate for an action, okay? So we work it out by taking our operators d and working out what d phi is. Well, d phi turns out to be psi bar plus theta bar f minus I x dot minus I theta bar theta psi bar dot, and d bar phi, well, it's psi plus theta f plus I x dot plus I theta bar theta psi dot. One is the complex conjugate in the other. So our superfield phi was a bosonic superfield, and the superfield that you get out of a bosonic superfield by applying a covariant derivative in superspace is a fermionic superfield. So this is an example, the first example we see of a fermionic superfield, whose lowest component is a fermion, highest component is a fermion as well. And so now there is a no-brainer to calculate what we get by taking the highest component of that. The highest component of the product of these two clearly will contain this times this, this times this, and this times this, right? It's all this and nothing else. And so we immediately see that the action is a number times f squared plus x dot squared. and I forgot the fermion, so just the bosonic part. The fermionic part I will write later. So the bosonic part of d phi d bar phi is this. By comparing this to this, we want that this number be 1/2. And so our superspace action, after we do all this, is this. Not superspace, sorry, component action. Where is it? So the total action S kinetic plus potential is integral over the whole superspace, 1/2 d phi d bar phi plus w phi. So this is the real action that we can write. Already at this point, you can ask whether this is the most general action I can write. And it's obviously not, because I can multiply here by any function of phi, and that's still a superfield and supersymmetry invariant. As well as I can include higher powers of derivatives, but that will give rise to higher derivative actions. But even at the two derivative levels, we have not written the most general action yet. In any case, this is the action, and it's equal to integral over dt, 1/2 x dot squared minus plus 1/2 f squared minus f double prime minus w double prime psi-bar psi plus I psi-bar psi dot. So this is the action, precisely the action that we had above, up to an integration by parts in the fermion kinetic terms. And that's the only difference. And the only other difference is that instead of the potential term, we have this weird field F, which was the highest component of our supermultiplet, which couples to W prime. But note that in the action, F appears with no derivatives. So F has no derivatives in the action. And so it is an auxiliary field and can be integrated out. So what we mean by that is that using this action, we define a path integral. The action is supersymmetric, so the path integral measure has to be supersymmetric as well. And the path integral measure is, of course, integral dx, df, d psi bar. And I leave it to you to show that it's supersymmetric. And so we can integrate out f and up to some normalization factor in the path integral measure that just corresponds to solving for f from its classical equation of motion and substituting back in the Lagrangian. So integrate over df, so which means solve f from equation of motion and plug back into L. And the result that we get is then precisely this type of interaction. Why? Because solving for f, well, let's do it. Solving for f, f is w prime on shell. And so solving for f means substituting f equal w prime. And if you look at the 1/2 and the minus signs, what you get is precisely w prime squared. So f is equal to w prime, so 1/2 f squared minus f w prime is minus 1/2 w prime squared. So get action you want, namely this one. So it is not a big deal that we have reproduced this action that we started with from some weird formalism. What is interesting about the formalism that it allows us to generalize it. And in particular, superfield formalism allows us to write most general action, supersymmetric action with a given superfield content. You simply have to write down the most general function of your superfields and their covariant derivatives and integrate over theta and theta bar, and here you go. In particular, to two derivative level, with many superfields, the most general action is as follows. I'll write it here. This most general action plays an important role, well, first of all, in that second paper of Witten in Journal of Differential Geometry that I referred you to. And it also plays a role, albeit in one dimension higher, in string theory. So the most general action is then something like this. So we have many fields. So I can write something like that. And you can work out the component expression for this action. And it turns out that this is the so-called nonlinear sigma model on a Riemannian manifold with metric G. Yes? It's the most general supersymmetric action which doesn't have more than two time derivatives in it, in that sense. And it's real. Yes. Good question. Good question. Actually, I don't have a proof of that, but from sort of superspace geometry, it kind of makes sense, right? The most general translational invariant action is something that is an integral over all space. So you expect that if you replace space by superspace, that result should hold. Oh, it doesn't. Well, okay. What doesn't work? Okay, let's. The main problem there. Good. Okay, I dug myself into a hole. Good. no, thank you. Thank you. Yes. So, what doesn't work there is finding superfields whose field content is not unusually large. It doesn't contain huge sets of auxiliary fields that you can have to somehow integrate over in the end of the day. And the reason is that as you increase the number of dimensions and the number of supersymmetries especially, the number of component fields grows very much. And a general superfield has all kinds of components. And it's a difficult task, and for what I understand unsolved, whether there is a proof that there is no solution, I don't know, to find for theories with higher amount of supersymmetry to find superfields whose content realizes the minimally reducible representations of supersymmetry. So now how to address this question that you asked, I don't know. Besides the qualitative level, I don't know. In four-dimensional n equal one, the statement is true, I believe. Yes, but in, I don't know of a proof. Yes. Oh, that's integration by parts, right? In superspace. Yeah, yeah. That would affect, of course, the G, but in this case. But yes, you can. Okay. When are we supposed to finish? 4 o'clock, right? Good, good. Okay. So we are out of one dimension. Lovely. Okay. Now, as I said, this thing generalizes very quickly to two dimensions. Okay? Well, to T you have to add X, and you have to modify a little bit the covariant derivatives, and then you get, so, there's slight modifications. And the slight modification is already at the level of the algebra, because in a two-dimensional theory, on the right-hand side, you should get the momentum, which has now two components rather than just the Hamiltonian, because it's a relativistic generalization of supersymmetry. So that leads to some modification of the supercharges and the covariant derivatives, but actually the formal expression is very much the same. It's basically integral dt dx, d theta bar, d phi, d bar phi, g of phi, plus w of phi. So it's lovely, except I didn't tell you what d and d bar are. And they should be modified somewhat because they will involve both of d dx somehow. Okay, but we won't do that in two dimensions. But that's what it looks like, and this is called 1,1 supersymmetry. It also generalizes to three dimensions, 2 + 1 dimensions, and then you have to do a little bit of work. You have to go from the D and the D bar to our previous definitions, Q1 and Q2, and then 1 and 2 become spinor indices in three dimensions. So the SO2 automorphism of the SO2 automorphisms of the supersymmetry algebra that we talked about, which is evident as SO2 in the D1, D2 notation, becomes part of the spatial rotations in three dimensions. And you actually have an entire SO2. So anyway, it generalizes to three dimensions too. And this is where it stops. In higher than three dimensions, there are no supersymmetric theories with this amount of supersymmetry. So what we want to do in the next of these lectures is to consider four dimensions. So the theory that I choose to consider is the simplest supersymmetric theory in four dimensions. And this is the N equal 1 theory. So what we want to do for the rest of this lecture series is to consider N equal 1s using 4D. It is the simplest in the sense that it has the smallest amount of supersymmetry. These are in 4D. N equal 1 theories are the only ones that allow chiral fermions. And if you're interested in using these theories to describe any property of nature, you're stuck with N equal 1. N equal ones, by the only ones, I mean the only supersymmetric theories. N equal 2 and N equal 4 theories are non-chiral. They can also dynamically break supersymmetry. Whereas theories with higher amount of supersymmetry in four dimensions cannot break supersymmetry dynamically. And so if you're interested in using dynamical supersymmetry breaking to generate small scales, you may hope that the dynamics of these theories have something to do with the hierarchy problem. And so they're a good, these theories are a good playground for that. In fact, this is why they were first introduced in particle theory. And so there's these possibilities, and they have lots of interesting dynamics, just for from a theoretical point of view. Well, you may say, you know, Seiberg-Witten is interesting, certainly, but these N equal 1 theories have, you know, because they're so much less constrained by symmetry, the interesting dynamics that you can get out of them is a lot more interesting, I think. So there is confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, Seiberg dualities, and chiral symmetry breaking, Seiberg dualities, all kinds of interesting things. So this is why we study them. You pick your motivation. Our goal here will not be to study these things. Our goal will be to study how to write actions which are supersymmetric for these theories in four dimensions. And we may study some properties, but that will be it. And then Philip Argyris and Gordy Kane will tell you about this, and Gordy will tell you about this part and how to use it in particle theory. So, as usual, we'll start with the algebra. We want to find the we'll just declare what the algebra is. The N equal 1 algebra is generated by four supercharges, Q alpha and Q bar alpha dot, where the Q bar alpha dot is the complex conjugate of Q. Alpha and alpha dot are two component spinor indices, SL2C. Gachasso told you all about them yesterday, and also they're in the appendices of Wes and Begger. And the difference between the products that Gachasso used with our products will be that our things will be anti-commuting. So our products will be symmetric, and his are anti-symmetric. But that's that's something for you to worry about. So these are SL2C left or right indices. So we have four supercharges. We say four because we have alpha is equal to one or two, and the thing is complex. Okay, so there are two two complex supercharges. So what is the algebra? It's actually very similar to the algebra we had before. It's this. So Q alpha dot is 2i sigma m alpha alpha dot pm. And I apologize, but I use Wessenberger notation. So m is what you would normally call mu, is 0, 1, 2, 3. It's the space-time vector index. P is the momentum generator. So if you go to the rest frame, where only the non-zero component of momentum is zero, then you find, of course, the usual quantum mechanics algebra, but with a larger amount of supercharges, not two, but four. And there is other commutation relations. The Qs itself anti-commute. P and Q commutes. Commute, sorry. And of course, the algebra of the Poincaré group in four dimensions doesn't involve only momenta. It also involves the generators of Lorentz transformations. Those I don't display because they're equivalent to saying that Pm is a vector in the Lorentz transformation, and Q alpha dot transform as left-handed or right-handed spinners under Lorentz transformations. And I'm not going to write that. Okay. So I use Wessenberger notations, and I have to get my other notes. So somebody asked me earlier, you can use any other book on supersymmetry. It doesn't matter. The notation is bound to be different. It's different in every book. So that's part of the trait. The reason I like the book of Wessenberger is it's very concise. Once you understand what's going on, there aren't too many words, so you can find what you want. Especially the new edition, it has a lot of chapters which you only find things in papers. So we can go very fast now. Why? Because we learned everything about superfields and superspace we ever wanted to know, at least for doing global supersymmetry. So we'll follow a similar path. We'll introduce superspace, but now superspace will have, you know, not just time, it will have these guys. We have the bosonic coordinates, our fields are our functions of Xm, and they are functions of the four fermionic coordinates. Okay? And then we want to realize, theta alpha dot is theta alpha dagger. The theta's anti-commute. I'm not going to write it down. They're nilpotent, and so on. So we want to realize the supercharges as differential operators. That's one-to-one with what we had in the quantum mechanics case, except that I can go fast, because dm is just ddxm, and q bar alpha dot and these supercharges obey the algebra where you replace Pm by minus ID. Or actually ID. Ooh, there's a mistake here. I believe this should be P. Now let me check. You know, let's leave it at that. And, well, it says I, so. They cannot both be true. Anyway, we'll check that, okay? I'll tell you. I'll let you know tomorrow. It's not so important. Anyway, these are the supercharges. They are nilpotent. They obey the supersymmetry algebra. And one comment about dimensional reduction of these theories, because it's important for people who work in lower dimensions. So n equal 1 in 4D. When you dimensionally reduce to 3D, basically, what does this mean? This means taking, say, D2 and putting it to 0, right? You say there is no X2. And then you get what is called n equal 2 in 3D. And if you further reduce to 2D by taking also d2 and d1 equals 0, then you get what is called 2, 2 supersymmetry in 2D. And you can further reduce to quantum mechanics by taking d3 to 0, and then you get some quantum mechanics with 4 supercharges. Anyway, that's just for you to know. These 2,2 models play some role in string theory. So now our goal is to learn how to write supersymmetric actions. So let's see. We want to look at superfields, right? That's how we started in 2D. Sorry, in quantum mechanics. And the problem that we'll see here is that if we write the most general superfield, it has way too many components. And from experience, you can argue that the simplest supersymmetry multiples that you expect in 4 dimensions are those that consist of a complex scalar field and a Weyl fermion. After all, supersymmetry should be relating fermions to bosons. The smallest fermion representation is a Weyl fermion. On shell, it has 2 degrees of freedom, right? So if you want to have that being related to some other field, what are the possibilities, right? One possibility is to have it related to a scalar. It has to be a complex scalar because the number of degrees of freedom on shell should match. The other possibility is for it to be a vector. A vector on shell has also 2 degrees of freedom. So those are the 2 basic representations of supersymmetry. See, I did the representation theory in words. Of course, anyway. Simplest representations of n equal 1 for d sub z. One complex scalar plus Weyl fermion. Or Weyl fermion plus vector. Massless, of course. And so our goal is to find what are the superfields that give rise to that. Right? We expect to have superfields where the component fields basically reduce to this and this, and this and this. And we see that we are in trouble when we write down the most general superfield. So let's just write it down. We'll need a lot of space. So just like I did in quantum mechanics, I write down all terms that I can until the thetas vanish. Because there are 4 thetas, the highest term will have 4 thetas in it, but there's a lot of terms coming before. So there is a function f, then I can have this. So these are all functions of x, which I will not indicate further because I need space. Then there is this. Then there is this. Then there is this. And then there is this. Then there is this. And I'm almost done. So look how many components fields there are. This is one component field. These are 2 component fields. These are 2 other component fields. This is 1. This is 1. This is 4, if it's not massless. This is 2. This is 2. And this is 1. And just one simple note is that I didn't write theta with different indices here because theta alpha theta beta is proportional to epsilon alpha beta theta theta. So there is no independent invariant because of anti-commutativity. And all kinds of useful identities like that you can see in Wessenberger and use them to your desire. So we see that the general superfield has way too many components, right? So what is the way out? The way out is to impose constraint. Too many components. So we want to restrict the number of components. But we want to restrict the number of components in the following way. We want this constraint that we impose to restrict the number of components to be supersymmetric. That first of all. And second, we want this constraint to not involve differential equations in X space. Because we don't want the constraint to restrict the behavior of the fields in X. We want to write actions for off-shell fields, which could be arbitrary. Okay? So we need to impose constraints. Constraints which should satisfy supersymmetric. So you don't want the constraints to violate supersymmetry. And B, they should not lead, should not involve differential equations in X mu, because we don't want them to restrict the behavior of the fields. So this is where the task is difficult in any theory. This part, operators, is very easy to do. So one obvious constraint that you can impose, oh, and again, the superfield, just like in quantum mechanics, can be bosonic if the lowest component is bosonic, or it can be fermionic if the lowest component is fermionic. So one obvious constraint that you can impose is to impose that the field be real. So if you impose that F dagger equals F, that constraint will not violate supersymmetry. One possibility F equals F dagger. That does not violate supersymmetry because supersymmetry is generated by a Hermitian operator. So it's a supersymmetric constraint. And the resulting field, if F is bosonic, this result is what is called, this results in what is called a vector superfield. Will play an important role. So here we introduce that. Its components, in most, in their most generality, you get by imposing hermeticity on this. So there will be some relation between this and this, between this and this, between this and this, etc. So you work that out. So that's called the vector superfield. We'll study vector superfield later. It turns out the other interesting multiplet, which is the one that consists of fermions and scalars, is described by what is called the chiral superfield. And to describe that, we need to introduce our friends, the supersymmetric covariant derivatives. We already did that in quantum mechanics, so it's a similar exercise to do in this theory, and we can just write them down. So we want a set of covariant derivatives, which are basically derivatives with respect to the four thetas, derivatives with theta 1, theta 2, theta bar 1, and theta bar 2, and we want them to anti-commute with supersymmetry. And these derivatives, well, you write down by basically demanding that that be true. And it's easier to write the answer. So this is the d alpha, the d bar alpha dot, it's its complex conjugate, just like in quantum mechanics. And these derivatives obey, basically they anti-commute with the supercharges. Plus complex conjugate, and yes? Oh yes, thank you very much, thank you, yes. I don't know how much I'm trying to squeeze in today's lecture, so no, there is no reason to. So the d alpha d beta is zero. Is zero plus complex conjugate, and they obey a supersymmetry algebra with the opposite sign. Whereas the Q's obey this algebra with a plus. So these are called supersymmetric covariant derivatives. Why they're supersymmetric, they just commute with supersymmetry. And so using those derivatives, it turns out that you can impose a constraint on a general superfield, which does not lead to derivative relations in X space. And we'll finish today on just introducing that field, and we'll study its properties and the most general Lagrangian tomorrow. Okay, so these fields are called chiral superfields. A chiral superfield is bosonic. It's complex, and it obeys the equation, the d bar alpha dot on phi of x, theta, and theta bar is 0. And obeys this constraint. The complex conjugate of a chiral superfield is called an anti-chiral superfield. The complex conjugate is anti-chiral. Its phi dagger obeys d alpha phi dagger 0. So we'll study the component content of these fields tomorrow. And let me just advertise what you're going to get. First of all, these chiral superfields are the contain the meta fields of a supersymmetric gauge theory. So in the supersymmetric generalization of the standard model, for example, all the meta fields, all the quarks and leptons, etc., are elements of these chiral fields. We will see that the physical component fields in a chiral superfield are a Weyl fermion and a complex scalar. We will learn how to write the most general Lagrangian of these fields, and eventually we'll learn also how to gauge global symmetries in those theories and write the most general Lagrangian for a supersymmetric gauge theories in gauge theory in four dimensions, and that will be it. Okay, and the rest you can read Wessenberger and you know, use it in your studies. So that's it for today, and I'll see you tomorrow. Yes.
Counting for a supersymmetry is becoming.
Yes. Yes. The counting.
You start with a four-dimensional
n equal one. Yeah.
Then
you get.
Why get n equal two in three dimensions?
Because it's twice the. You see, what people call n equal one in any dimension is the smallest amount of supersymmetry you can have.
Right.
So in three dimensions, the smallest amount of supersymmetry you can have is two supercharges, and that's called n equal one. It's very confusing. So when you have four supercharges,
right,
then it's called n equal two because it's twice the minimal amount.
When I have four supersymmetries.
So
why have three?
No. So in 3D